The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from a variety of Harvard publications, and first I'm going to finish up the Harvard Heart Letter of March 2023, with an article entitled Addressing Language Challenges After a Stroke. With persistent effort and help from assistive tools, stroke survivors can continue to improve their ability to communicate even years after a stroke. Last November, John Fetterman won the election for the open U.S. Senate seat in Pennsylvania just 6 months after experiencing a stroke that left him with auditory processing issues. During interviews and debates, Fetterman used closed captioning, one of several technologies that can help people cope with language-based disorders, known collectively as aphasia. Aphasia, which can range from mild to severe, may affect just one or several aspects of language processing, including speaking, understanding, reading, and writing. Although different types of brain injuries and conditions can cause aphasia, stroke is the most common. Of the nearly 800,000 people in the United States who have a stroke every year, 30% will experience aphasia. But through a process called neuroplasticity, the brain has the ability to rewire brain cells and recover lost function, says Dr. Randall Black Schaefer, chief of the Division of Stroke and Neurology of the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at the Harvard Medical School. Neuroplasticity is greatest in the first several months after a stroke, but people who've had a stroke who keep working on their language processing problems can continue to improve for years, she says. Many rehabilitation centers have comprehensive aphasia programs that are designed to treat people a year or more after a stroke. In one-on-one sessions with a speech-language pathologist, people practice repeating words, naming things and people, and reading and writing. A framework known as the Life Participation Approach to aphasia uses a variety of methods, techniques, and tools to help people more fully engage in their lives, says speech-language pathologist Lynn Brady Wagner, associate director of the Harvard-affiliated Spalding Stroke Wellness Institute. One example is having a note, either on a wallet card or your smartphone, that includes basic information about your specific limitations and ways people can help, like speaking slowly and using gestures, says Brady Wagner. The closed captioning Fetterman used can help with forms of receptive aphasia, while people with expressive aphasia might use a speech-generating device. Health insurance usually covers only a limited number of post-stroke language rehabilitation sessions, so people pay out of pocket for extended therapy. During the COVID-19 epidemic, many sessions shifted to virtual visits, says Dr. Black Schaefer. If these online visits can continue, it would be a huge boon, especially for people who don't live close to a rehabilitation center or whose strokes have left them with mobility problems. People with aphasia may also be able to take advantage of other options, like local in-person or online community support groups. Many colleges and universities have accredited speech and language programs. Those with on-site graduate student clinics can provide continued interactive therapy for people with aphasia, which are provided pro bono or on a sliding fee scale, says Brady Wagner. Finally, people can also use specialized apps designed to help people practice language skills. The National Aphasia Association, aphasia.org, and aphasia spelled A-P-H-A-S-I-A, provides a list of these apps. The article also mentions that there's different types of aphasia. Aphasia results from injury to specific parts of the brain responsible for expressing and understanding language. Most often, an ischemic stroke in the left side of the brain is to blame. The location of the clot and the extent of the resulting damage dictates the type and severity of aphasia. There are three main types. The first is expressive aphasia, also known as Broca's aphasia. This occurs because of damage to a part of the frontal lobe. This area is in charge of arranging words and sentences and translating meaning into sounds. People understand what others are saying and know what they want to say, but they struggle to get the words out. Next is receptive aphasia. This is called Wernicke's aphasia and results from damage to a part of the temporal lobe that connects information about word meanings with the speech output centers in Broca's area. People can often speak fluently, but don't always make sense, and they also have difficulty understanding what others are saying. Then there's global aphasia, which occurs when a stroke causes extensive damage to the front and the back region of the left side of the brain. And now today I'm going to introduce a publication that we haven't read previously from the Harvard Medical School, and it's entitled the Harvard Women's Health Watch. And I thought it might be of interest for me to read this, so we're going to start with the March 2023 issue of the Harvard Women's Health Watch. And the first article is entitled, At-Home Tests, Are They a Help or a Hindrance? At some point in the past 3 years, a great many of us stood at our kitchen or bathroom counters, swabbing our nostrils or throat and counting the minutes until we learned if we had COVID-19. How do we do that? With at-home medical tests offering rapid results, an innovation that has changed the way we approach our health. This collective pandemic experience transformed our dwellings into mini medical testing labs, but it also drove home the benefits of being able to check ourselves for conditions that might steer our actions in the short term. Say by isolating to avoid infecting others, or even guide health decisions for years to come. A new nationally representative poll shows that half of older Americans have used at least one kind of at-home health test. The survey, part of the University of Michigan's National Poll on Healthy Aging, included 2,163 adults aged 50 through 80 who were questioned online or by phone in July of 2022. Rapid COVID tests certainly changed the appetite for at-home testing, but these types of tests have been available for decades, only growing in variety and reliability. Remember urinating on a stick to find out if you were pregnant? Now you can also test your DNA, reveal urinary tract infections or sexually transmitted infections, predict ovulation, and learn if you're transitioning to menopause. You can measure cholesterol and blood sugar levels, tease out food sensitivities, and hunt for signs of colorectal cancer. These are just a few of the dozens of conditions these tests can screen for, diagnose, or monitor. But home-based medical tests also present distinct drawbacks. I think these tests can be useful, but we have to appreciate their limitations, says Dr. Daniel Sands, a primary care doctor at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. In human biology, more information isn't always better, unless it's perfect information, and most tests aren't. It's fairly simple to obtain at-home tests with various kits available online or in stores. We can buy many over the counter, while a doctor must authorize others. Most involve taking a sample of a body fluid, saliva, mucus, blood, or urine, and applying it to kit materials. Some tests provide immediate results, while others must be mailed to a lab. Convenience is the biggest advantage, helping people avoid time-consuming medical appointments. Nearly three-fourths of those surveyed by the National Poll on Healthy Aging said they viewed at-home tests as more convenient than those they take through their doctor. Some tests, but not all, provide practical information, especially for people who can't access medical care or aren't insured. Ideally, the tests also fuel proactive health care, spurring people to get treated earlier. Dr. Sands says, he points to at-home tests for pregnancy, UTIs, and sexually transmitted infections as particularly worthwhile. If you're uncomfortable getting tested for a STI, I'd rather you learn this information privately and then contact your doctor to be treated, he says. Knowledge is power, and it's good to have that information, particularly when it's actionable, Dr. Sands says. In fact, when we can't see patients face-to-face, like during the pandemic, home testing can be part of what we recommend to determine what might be going on. But some home tests may just muddy the waters. These include tests that analyze your DNA and answer questions about ancestry, but may also suggest your risks of developing various types of cancer or other life-changing conditions. Genetic tests are popular among Dr. Sands' patients, leading to interesting conversations about what they mean and what to do with that information. They can be fraught with problems. You need to understand that just because you're at increased risk for disease doesn't mean you're going to get it, he says. And you also open a whole can of worms when you find out you're at higher risk. It may make you anxious for the rest of your life. Some diseases you might be at risk for may not have effective screening tests. At-home test results might also be inaccurate, potentially leading to serious consequences. With an incorrect diagnosis, we may needlessly opt for or skip costly or risky treatments, such as a medication or surgery. A small study of patients taking home-based tests, whose results were double-checked in a lab, showed that 4 in 10 had gotten false positive results, meaning they didn't have the condition their at-home kit indicated, says the October 2020 review published in the Archives of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine. The problem with a false positive is it increases your anxiety level and also forces doctors to do additional testing to hunt that result down, Dr. Sands says. And those additional tests may be more expensive, invasive, or risky. Some people may be tempted to keep at-home tests private, even at their own peril. 92% of older adults from the National Poll on Healthy Aging agreed results should be shared with a doctor. Only 55% of those who used these tests for a non-COVID infection shared their results with their primary care doctor. That number dropped to fewer than 1 in 10 of those who used genetic tests. At-home tests can be expensive. Another reason a conversation with your doctor is a smart idea. The doctor can approve tests that are covered by insurers, so you're better off going to your doctor first, Dr. Sands says. People might be embarrassed to let their doctor know they are doing these tests at home, but they don't need to be. Call me old-fashioned, but I really believe your primary care doctor should be your trusted health advisor. If you're doing things health-related, like getting a test, you should share that with your doctor. The article goes on to include a section called Making the Most of At-Home Testing. While at-home medical tests come with explicit instructions, many people still do them wrong, jeopardizing the accuracy of the test, says Dr. Lynn Ewell, director of the Division of Laboratory and Transfusion Medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. I often wondered, did someone home testing for COVID really swab their nostrils the way they're supposed to? Or do they do it haphazardly? Similarly, the way they handle their sample may not be as rigorous as needed. You should always follow instructions to the letter. This includes reviewing all images to ensure you understand how to take the test properly and interpret the results. Many tests require specific timing and sample amounts. If the test needs to be sent to a laboratory after you collect your sample, check if the lab is certified under CLIA, the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendment of 1988. This government seal of approval designates high-performing labs that consistently provide reliable and timely results. When in doubt, call. Similarly, call the test manufacturer if you're unsure how to proceed with taking the test. A toll-free telephone number is typically listed on boxes and instructions. Don't change your medications or doses based on the results of a home test without talking to your doctor first. And follow up when needed. If any symptoms that prompted you to take a home test don't get better, call your doctor. Do the same if your results are troubling or don't seem to make sense. Now we're going to continue with the Harvard Women's Health Watch of March 2023. And the next section is called Ask the Doctors. And it's written by Dr. Tony Golan and Dr. Hope Ricciotti. The first question is, I was outdoors on a bright day and noticed a grayish dot that wasn't there before drift through my field of vision. What could it be? Answer, you likely have a floater, an aptly named shadow that's shaped like a spot, line, ring, or squiggle, and becomes more noticeable in certain types of light. Floaters can develop at any age, but occur most often between 50 and 75. There are small flecks of protein called collagen that are part of the vitreous humor, the gel-like filling in our eye. As we get older, the vitreous material can pull away from the retina at the back of the eye, creating floaters. They're also more likely if you're nearsighted or have had cataract surgery. While floaters are bothersome, they shouldn't hamper your ability to see. Don't be alarmed if you have a few floaters that don't change over time. On bright days, simply wearing sunglasses may help. But see a doctor immediately if you notice a sudden increase in floaters, flashes of light in your field of vision, a loss of side vision, or eye pain. These may be signs of a torn or detached retina, which requires emergency treatment to avoid vision loss. Here's the second question in Ask the Doctors. I've gotten hives from time to time when I've been overly stressed, but now I have a case that won't quit after 6 weeks. What is going on? No one welcomes these red itchy welts that crop up on our skin. Many things can lead to a temporary case of hives, including allergic reactions to food, medications, bug bites, pollen, latex, or animal dander. Like you, some people also develop them when they're stressed, or in response to ultraviolet light or excess skin pressure. Hives are most common in women, especially in the between the ages of 30 and 50. Most cases of hives go away within several days to a couple of weeks. If they last 6 weeks or longer, you may have autoimmune hives. This happens when your immune system mistakenly targets healthy tissue, in this case, triggering a skin reaction. Autoimmune hives are more common in people with other autoimmune conditions, like lupus or thyroid disease, rheumatoid arthritis, or celiac disease. Anyone whose hives last longer than a few weeks should see a doctor. The next section in the Harvard Women's Health Watch is entitled Anxiety Overload. Physical signs of anxiety can provoke alarm and avoidance, but you can learn how to thrive. The emotional signs of anxiety, nervousness, restlessness, distraction, the clenched jaw, almost always occur in tandem with dry mouth, nausea, sweating hands, which can then magnify our anxious feelings. When anxiety crosses a line, unique to each individual, everyday stressors can translate into disruptive physical symptoms that make it difficult to live normally. Profound anxiety can provoke everything from dizziness and diarrhea to heart-pounding panic that leaves you gasping for breath. If you're feeling lightheaded, your heart's racing and chest tightening, it really contributes to a sense that something terrible is going to happen, says Jacqueline Bullis, an assistant psychologist in the Division of Depression and Anxiety Disorders at Harvard-affiliated McLean Hospital. But physical symptoms themselves aren't the problem, Bullis says. It's really the way we respond to them. We want people to learn that these distressing physical sensations aren't dangerous, and they can learn to tolerate them. Anxiety in itself can prove useful under the right circumstances, spurring us to make sure we're prepared for that big presentation at work. When it's at the Goldilocks spot where it's not too intense or too suppressed, anxiety motivates us, Bullis says. If we were never anxious, we wouldn't get anything done. Extreme physical sensations, however, stem from the body's fight or flight response. In these moments, we might react the same way to a perceived threat like public speaking, as we would to a real danger like a home intruder. During an anxiety attack, symptoms can turn so dramatic that people believe they're having a heart attack or a stroke. People having severe anxiety attacks almost universally feel they're about to die, says Dr. Arthur Barsky, a psychiatrist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. They experience it as impending medical emergency rather than anxiety, which is going to worry them even more. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You should always seek a doctor's advice for any potentially dangerous symptom like chest pain or shortness of breath to make sure anxiety is indeed the root cause. But once that's established, your next task is learning how to respond in situations you know will hit the panic button. Many people will avoid common scenarios and retreat from potentially unpleasant interactions to stop anxiety before it starts, but limit their lives in the process. This is the wrong approach. CBT is the gold standard. What's the best path to overcome severe anxiety? Cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is the gold standard, effective in many cases. Often people wait too long, only to be astonished how quickly they can gain control of symptoms using CBT. Results typically take 4 to 6 months. A form of CBT called exposure therapy engages you in activities designed to provoke uncomfortable physical sensations, causing you to become breathless or feel momentarily panicked. We're going to be confronting things you've gotten good at avoiding, Bullis says. The more you do it, the more used to it you get. It's kind of like a vaccine. By repeatedly and deliberately exposing yourself to scary physical situations, you can reduce the impact they have on you in the real world. Short-acting medications like beta blockers or benzodiazepines can be used for situational anxiety to calm extreme physical reactions. But the problem with these medications is they may reinforce the idea that the symptoms are dangerous, Bullis says, and many people don't like being reliant on something to help them cope. A combination of therapies may be needed for severe cases, Bullis recommends, and seeking a therapist trained in CBT and asking what approaches he or she would use in your treatment. For help locating a skilled therapist, use online search tools provided by the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapy. www.abct.org and the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, www.adaa.org. Now we're going to go over a couple of brief discussions in the Harvard Women's Health Watch. And the first is, exercise can reduce fatigue in breast cancer patients undergoing radiation. Engaging in regular exercise may improve fatigue, along with physical and emotional well-being, among women undergoing radiation treatment for breast cancer, a new study suggests. The study, published online October 14, 2022, by the journal Breast Cancer, involved 89 women aged 32 to 78. When starting radiation therapy, 43 women were randomly chosen to complete a 12-week home-based exercise program. The other 46 did not participate. Patients in the exercise group did one or two strength training sessions weekly, along with 30 to 40 total minutes of aerobic exercise, including brisk walking or cycling. Researchers used questionnaires to assess the women's fatigue levels and other quality of life measures at four intervals, 6 weeks and 12 weeks after the study's start, as well as 6 months and 1 year after radiation therapy ended. Women in the exercise group reported significantly less fatigue than their peers while undergoing radiation treatment. Both groups reported improved emotional and physical well-being 6 months and 1 year after radiation ended, but only those in the exercise group experienced these improvements as early as 6 weeks after the study began. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.